feel that? Y'all feel that? Hey, this how we gonna get it done today. It's gonna take everybody. Feel that man next to you. Cause when you weak, that's who you leaning on. When you need to play, that's who you leaning on. When you don't think you can get it done, that's who you doing it for. If y'all wanna get this done, we gonna do it together. We gonna ride, it's gonna take pride, fellas. Let's get this done, bring it up.
This is the Pedestrian Podcast.
I don't know. That's just what pedestrian, average, mediocre receivers do. What's up? What's up? My man Deion Sanders, we all right, huh? We all right? Yeah, we all right. We're going to go to the Super Bowl again, being all right.
The official podcast of the UK Seahawkers. Here are your hosts, Stuart Court.
Le'Veon Bell wants to be paid as an offensive weapon, when if you're the Steelers, he's come across as a bit of a weapon himself in different ways.
And Adam Nathan.
It's tricky because Hugh Jackson said nothing for me to shove him in.
We are going to follow you. Gotcha, you lead us, gotcha, okay? Let's go do it. Like I told you before, you lead us to darkness, we will follow you.
Go Hawks.
Welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, still the one, only unofficial UK Seahawkers podcast. This week we come back off a Seahawks loss, and to go through that and go through everything that's coming up this weekend down in Los Angeles, myself, Stuart Court, is, as ever, joined by Mr. Adam Nathan. How are we, sir?
I'm good. It feels weird not to be recording in the what do they call it?
The witching hour.
The witching hour could be a good one, yeah. And I've had a coffee versus a whiskey, which is a very rare way to record. But maybe I'll be more lucid and make a little bit of sense for the first time.
Yeah, it's always the hope. Yes, obviously the Seahawks did return home to Centric Field to face what most people were expecting is going to be a tight, tense affair. And later on, it was not to that. If anything, it was a bit infuriating on Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a frustrating one, because although I do think the Chargers are a better team than us, it's always a bit annoying when you end up losing a game that you otherwise could have won if you'd cleaned things up and not made individual mistakes and maybe were schemed slightly better. And yeah, it's just a bit frustrating that I think the hinged on that game. And looking at the road now, it's pretty tough. If you can find me 10 wins on the schedule now, I'd be impressed. Yeah. And I think it's probably going to take 10 wins to get to the playoffs. So yeah. I think it's pretty tricky now. And so that's why it's a bit of a shame. Albeit, I do think we're playing against overall a far superior team.
Yeah, I think Mitchell Lance put on Twitter as well that this game was a year too early for the Seahawks squad. And that's probably what it was. But I think the most important thing was because the thing going wrong, the issues that the team had, were issues they hadn't had for the previous month and were so clear and blatant changes that the coaches could make in the game. They just did not make them, did they? With it is on top of those, maybe compounding that, but that kind of added to the frustration because everything was different to the month before, really, wasn't it?
Well, I guess it really all comes down to coaching for me. I mean, obviously Russell Wilson didn't have his best game, but you can't expect the guy to be perfect every week. And unfortunately, the way we're playing now, you're kind of relying on him to be basically flawless in order to win. And that's not really sustainable. No. You know, obviously, Chris Carson was running fantastically well. But again, if you're entirely reliant on him to carry the team through, and you know, you're saying you can't really build a scheme without him, I kind of thought that the Chargers got a bit shaken up by us with the first score that we had, you know, which was a beautiful half quarter drive, basically, from 75 yards, and it's a real sort of set your marker up of, you know, we're physical, we're going to be good. And then they scored in about 8 plays after that, and it kind of felt like, oh, this is a proper team we're playing against. And it felt to me, especially when Carson went down, that they were just ready for us. And all of the fears that people had about Schottenheimer, who, you know, we're neither of us are his biggest fan, let's be honest, I kind of feel came to a head in the second half, and the Chargers were looking at us thinking, okay, what else have you got? And it was nothing.
Yeah, well, I'm Wilson, and we'll get to play calling more intently in a bit. Russell Wilson, 26 to 39, 235, 2 touchdowns, and a pick 6. His second of the 2018 season, just his third in his NFL career, which is now in its 8th year. I can't remember seventh year, which says a lot also about the guy calling the plays as well, but we're going to talk more. But Russell Wilson, as you said, he wasn't anywhere near his best, and he left a couple of big-time plays out there. The biggest one was the one where he underthrew Jaron Brown by half of Seattle, didn't he? It was far too short, and if he gives it some air, Jaron Brown, even Doug Baldwin, can run under it for six, can't he?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes when you're just out of your depth in something in life, you kind of have that glazed look in your eyes. And not that Wilson's ever out of his depth on an NFL field, but he just had one of those days where you looked at him on the screen and you thought, you just don't look right. Like, no. you look really dazed and shaken up. And normally you look at him and he gives off such a confidence and, you know, you have so much faith in that he knows what to do, but he just has that. And I think that kind of links into when he holds the ball on the ball for too long to get sacked. I think it's kind of a symbiotic thing. And he just looked like he wasn't all there on Sunday, no. which very rarely happens on a beautiful day in Seattle. You know, normally it's the wet and the wind that causes that.
With all that, though, Russell Wilson was sacked four times. A couple of them were probably his fault, where he could have stepped up or at least got the ball out a bit quicker. And it's something which Pete Carroll, for a change, when it's... I think he shared the opinion that it's a bit harsh on Russell Wilson. He put a lot of the blame for those sacks, for those errors, for those misjudgments on number three, when a lot of other people are, in our opinion again, pointing the finger at other people, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, he's had probably 6 years of being really mollycoddled to a fault, and now it kind of feels like there's people are going way overboard and blaming him versus what is actually the root cause of the problem, which I would say is offensive scheming. You know, don't watch the tape, and how can anyone judge if you don't watch the tape, according to some of our friends on Twitter. But, you know, I think you can get a feel of the game and suggest that ultimately we have not really got any vague idea of a plan B, C, D, or E. And Wilson has won you two games in the last 2 weeks by playing absolutely flawlessly, right? And then all of a sudden it's just very short memory for blaming him on Sunday that, you know, he still made some pretty good throws, drives together, but schematically a lot of it seemed wrong, especially when we fell behind. So I'm pretty surprised at the level of stick he's getting, and yeah. I think it's pretty unfair, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean I think a few people have mentioned it in the questions when you posted the other day asking for questions for this that we look really one dimensional, which is just absolutely ridiculous. A lot of it was pinned on Chris Carson, who's a seventh round pick 2 years ago, but also someone who didn't practice a week and was a pretty high doubt to play on Sunday. The fact that so much of the game plan seemed hinged on his mere existence is short-sighted and really annoying, Adam.
It's like back in the 90s, Spurs saying you can only win when Darren Anderson's playing. And like that, that's all very well, because Anderson's a great player, and when he's fit, you know, you can build a team around him, but... The guy's called sick note, and ultimately Chris Carson has been out more than he's been in with his injuries. And if you're telling me that the only way you can build a game plan is around having Anderson, then that means you're not working hard enough schematically. You know, New Orleans, Kansas, the Rams, the Panthers, the Patriots, I would say, they could lose any of their frontline offensive players, and it doesn't really affect anything because they just do it a different way. You know, for the Saints, sometimes Mark Ingram has a big day. It was Kamara on Sunday. It'll be Michael Thomas and other times. It might be bloody Ben Watson sometimes, or it has been Willie Snead for them back in the day when he's played. They have ways in which that, you know, if a defense, you know, Belichick is famous for saying, or for being the guy that takes away your number one threat.
Yeah.
So if they play the Rams in the Super Bowl, they will take away Todd Gurley and make Jared Goff throw it. And that's fine. But then McVay will run misdirection. They'll use play action. They'll use screens. We just did none of that on Sunday. And it was just so... Gus Bradley is obviously a great defensive mind. And he must have been looking at this team thinking, you must have more than this, because this is easy.
Yeah, I mean, with the Rams, we go to them a bit, because we've played this, and they scored 20-odd points unanswered in New Orleans, and Todd Gurley barely got a yard in that second half. He only had like 70 yards on the day, but they still managed to put up 35 points against what is a pretty decent defense in New Orleans. It wasn't enough to win the game, but it just proves and compounds that point. I mean, Kareem Hunt, for the first few weeks of the season, was overshadowed by the greatest to ever do it in Patrick Mahomes. And then on Sunday, him and Travis Kelce got all the touchdowns to help the Chiefs. It's just like it was to a certain extent with for a few years with Marshawn Lynch when they get into Super Bowls and everything. It's all on the running game. But this year, with, as you say, with the injury and these the issues that Carson has actually staying on the field, it's just even more frustrating because at quarterback and with receiver, the amount of money they've invested in the receiver position, the amount of money with Ed Dixon, I know he's only played two games, they've invested at tight end position, it's just incredibly frustrating. And then, as I said to you the other day, if I ever had the chance of getting the same room as Brian Schottenheimer, it would be like the scene at the end of Glengarry Glen Ross, Adam.
Which, when you showed me the video, it was perfect. I mean, it's Schottenheimer's an easy target, and I mean, he is obviously a massive douche. Anyone that wears a visor and the clip with Wilson calling a lion a gazelle or whatever, and Wilson looks at him and just goes, okay. I mean, this is a guy that is just, you know, he's the classic example of a proper football man in the NFL who's kind of just there because his dad was there. And look, I have to say also, it's not helped that Pete Carroll is also fairly archaic in his offensive views. This isn't all on Schottenheimer.
No.
If Carroll wanted it a different way, Carroll would have it that way. But unfortunately, you've kind of got two of the same guys that are both fairly archaic in their views calling it. And it's no surprise that we've lost three out of the four games we've lost, probably due to poor offensive scheme.
Yeah, if Pete Carroll wanted to change how it was done, Brian Schottenheimer would not be in Seattle. There's a very good chance that Darrell Bevell would still be in Seattle, or people like DeFilippo, or whatever his name is, in Indianapolis. The reason Schottenheimer is here is because Pete Carroll didn't change his ways. I think someone put on Twitter earlier today that the Seahawks are 32nd in percentage of first down conversions on first down. I think it's just like 22%. And the guy said that they have no interest in getting a first down on first down, which is just absolutely just so archaic, as you said.
You and I can sit on the couch and pretty much look and see whether it's going to be a run or a pass just from watching it on TV.
Yeah.
And that is not sustainable. That's not good because I don't know anything. Like, you know, the fact I'm even on a podcast is disgraceful, to be honest.
Yeah, we've had those emails.
Yeah, exactly. that's what the fan always says. And if I can tell you whether it's going to be a run or a pass, that suggests that there's a problem. And there was a 5-minute period that summed it up for me. We had a 3rd and 18 in our own territory, and as with all long 3rd and longs, we ran an inside draw to the running back, and he picked up 10 yards and we punted. The Chargers had 3rd and 15 on a subsequent drive, and they threw a 50-yard bomb to Keenan Allen and a 20 and then ran it in with Melvin Gordon for 35 yards. Was it only a 34-yard pass to Keenan Allen?
No, 34-yard run from Gordon.
34-yard from Gordon. And like that for me just summed up the difference in proactive and aggressive coaching versus just sort of passive let the game, you know, that was the ultimate can you win the game in the first, second, third quarter versus what is actually aggressive, proactive play. And Brock, who had made a good point on social media that night, he said, you know, the main reason that the Seahawks lost was there was just a lack of violence. And I think he was right. I think defensively and on special teams, the Chargers were just more violent than us in all phases. And I think that's mentally and physically that they came to win, whereas we came to keep it close and win it at the end. And ultimately, that's not really going to get it done against these good teams.
No, I think when you put guys in your top tier, top five.
Yeah, 100%.
And they did an absolute thing to do that. If anything, they established themselves more in that upper echelon of teams in 2018. One person I do want to mention, obviously the receivers, Doug Baldwin had 4 catches, 77 yards. Nick Vanette found the end zone again, 6 catches, 52. Jaren Brown got his 3rd touchdown of the year yet again on his only 1 catch. He turned it into a touchdown as he did 3 weeks ago at Wembley. But David Moore, Adam, 2 catches for 16 yards a week after calling him a Hall of Famer. You took some flack from different people I was texting during the game as well. It's obviously it's only one game, there's a lot to go, but this is kind of what we were talking about, David Moore. There's going to be a lot more expectation on him to produce a level which is possibly unfair to him, isn't it?
I think people are being so unfair about that catch at the end, calling it a drop. The ball is shaped like an egg for a reason, because of the way it flies. And yes, the tip of the ball didn't massively change direction, to move it from, you know, 8 yards one way to 4 yards the other way. But if you watch a slow motion replay of it, the ball flips 90 degrees and is upright versus being a perfect spiral. Now, if you don't think that's going to make an enormous difference trying to catch it, go out and try and catching it right with your dad throwing you the ball, because it will make a huge difference, let alone Wilson zipping it at seven zillion miles an hour.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, people calling that a drop are just not thinking about the physics of how this thing works. Yeah. And yeah, more, you know, more is obviously being taken a bit of flack, but I think it's unnecessary and pretty unfair.
Yeah, it is.
And to counter that, Nick Vinette's touchdown should be seen as maybe one of the greatest catches I've ever seen in my entire life. Wilson has absolutely lamped it in there. Yes. And outside of his body, he's managed to catch it. I don't know how he did it. It was incredible.
With his fingers, like that, and Travis Kelce's catch. I think it might be one-handed, that one. They were exactly the same. Strength in the hands and wrist to do that is quite something. Obviously, Nick Nett is finally finding pay dirt, Adam.
Yeah, he looks decent. He surprisingly good, actually. And, you know, Wilson obviously trusts him. He is used, you know, regularly on big plays, I would say. You know, obviously, no Seahawk tight end is going to be, you know, used to Gronkowski level as, you know, your first receiver, but Wilson obviously trusts him and uses him in big moments, and can only be good for the team. Although it was a shame to see Ed Dixon just completely out of the game on Sunday.
Yeah, Dixon only had one target and he didn't manage to come down with that, and I've got to be honest, I do not remember it. But elsewhere, the O-line kind of did its job, but there's a bit of a worry coming out of the game with the injury to DJ Fluka, which appears he's going to be fine, but he's important, especially with number 99 lined up on the other side on Sunday.
Yeah, especially in the run game. I mean, the passing game against Donald is going to be terrifying at the best of times. So you'd like a human wall there in front of him. That'd be quite nice. It's a worry if Fluka's not right, because Posich, who I'd imagine will come in and play right guard, looks a big step down, and yeah, you know, it can't be Joey Hunt, because he looked an enormous step down on Sunday, gave up a sack and did not play well at all. So we could really use Fluka being fit. I think that's one of the knocks on him is durability, Fluka, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So it's pretty important that he can get himself back healthy, because we are going to need everything we can get on Sunday if we even stand a prayer.
Yeah, so it will be interesting to see what the injury report brings up, not just with Fluka and Carson, but also Bradley McDougall, who we can get onto now. We're talking about defense. As we say, Philip Rivers, I mean, he's getting some flack, which most opposing quarterbacks get from Seahawks fans in certain sections when they just do anything against the Seahawks. But I, like I said to, I think, Cedric, who posted on Facebook, I enjoy watching him play more than very few quarterbacks, because he's having the time of his life, and nothing else matters more than winning a game. And obviously, he's got that bit of bite in him. He's kind of like David Warner without being an absolute buffoon.
I absolutely love Rivers. I think his whole demeanour is great. I think he's a proper leader of men. Yeah, he gets pissed off about stuff, but I think that works to motivate those around him. And people moan about him whinging at the referees. This is if you do that. Ultimately,
yeah.
The more you moan, ultimately you're going to get yours. And you know, you see that in all sorts of sports. You know, the teams that sadly that moan most get the most decisions. I think Rivers is an absolutely brilliant quarterback. I think he's certainly a Hall of Famer, and I would love to see him go all the way once, because I think he really deserves it.
Yeah, he's. I mean, that draft class of him, Big Ben, and Eli Manning has done a lot, and the fact that he's the only one out of that trio not to have Super Ring is somewhat unfair. This is his fourth game against the Seahawks, and there's no two ways about it. He definitely has the Seahawks number. He's, even though the four games have been split between the Seahawks and Chargers, Rivers has thrown for 1,148 yards, 9 touchdowns, and just 2 interceptions for a QBR of 95.31. And he, as we feared, as we always mentioned from 4 years ago, he had his way with us again on Sunday, didn't he?
Yeah, just he is so good at diagnosing defenses and, you know, checking out of plays and checking into things. And the fact that his passing, his passer rating is better when he's under pressure than when he's not under pressure. He just says a lot about the guy. Yeah, he's fearless. He steps up in the pocket. You know, at times where Wilson drives us all mad by spinning out, yeah, Rivers steps up into the pocket under pressure. I think that's what really separates the very, very best guys from the nearly best guys. And Wilson can be that.
Yeah.
But I think Rivers, the regularity which he does that, really puts him in the upper echelon of quarterbacks. And he, you're right, he's great to watch.
Yeah, this is his 200th consecutive game, and that includes a game where he played in the playoffs 5 days after undergoing ACL surgery, which is just ridiculous. Powers of recovery or mental strength or whatever that is, it's just it's bananas, but holy crap. Elsewhere, Melvin Gordon, he's quite good, isn't he?
Yeah, do you know what? He's always the guy that, like, when I see him being taken with 9th or 10th or 11th pick in fantasy drafts, I think, really, Melvin Gordon? I think probably because his first couple of years, he just didn't really have that burst, but...
Carry on.
He really looked great on Sunday. He ran with a violence and an aggression that I didn't think he had, and he's really... You know, you should never completely change your view on a player after one game, and I'm not changing my view per se, but he really impressed me with how well he ran the ball, and he was a load.
Yeah, he had a really poor rookie year from a first-round running back draft pick, and then since then, especially this, the last 20 games he's played, he's been probably the second-best running back in the NFL behind Gurley, maybe Kareem Hunt as a thing, but... A rookie running back who's struggling and then turns it on is something that some people need to hold on to on Seahawks Twitter, isn't it? Because it's about Mr. Penny.
Oh, my. Oh, yeah, those people on Twitter really can be just a complete disgrace. They're such hot take merchants. I hope they know who they are, and I almost hope they're listening, even though they're not, because I'd love them to know they're being called out. It really is pathetic, some of the sensationalism, especially it's negative around players. You know, we all have a laugh at the expense of some players because, you know, you like someone, you don't like someone, that's fine. But the idea that Penny is a bust all of a sudden after 30 carries in the NFL is just completely nonsensical, especially when Pete Carroll comes out and says he's a volume player. Well, you know, if he's a volume player, then start him on Sunday and see what happens. What's the worst that can happen?
Elsewhere, the defense, they give up 19 points in the first half, but they really battened down the hatches and just waited for the offense to catch up, which they didn't until garbage time, really. But, I mean, Bobby Wagner, KJ Wright, the secondary, even with McDougal's injury, it did its job to a certain extent on Sunday, didn't it?
Yeah, I should just caveat that start him on Sunday if Chris Carson's injured. the most impressive person in the whole Seahawk building this year for me has been Ken Norton Jr. He came from an Oakland team last year that his defense was laughed at by how poor they were and how it just wasn't working. And I know that in Seattle, the defense will always be Pete Carroll's defense primarily, but they look much better coached now than they did under Chris Richard the last 2 years. You know, to hold some of these teams that they're holding to so few points is really impressive. And bear in mind that the talent gap in what they've got now and what they used to have is pretty vast. And I think they can take an awful amount of credit. And they deserve to be on the winning side on Sunday with the way they played. And they're just unlucky that that's not how it transpired. But I think you can only have positive words about the defense in general because they're playing miles better than I could possibly have hoped them to do.
For the Chargers on the defensive side, the familiar face was calling the plays on Sunday, Gus Bradley. And while he had a bit of a struggle, as probably anyone would have in Jacksonville, he just proved what a top five, top defensive coach he is in this league. Because he dialed up the perfect game plan. And, I mean, against Detroit kind of were torched and they played a lot of the game in man coverage. And apparently on Sunday, the Chargers spent a lot of time in zone, and we just, as we said, the one-dimensional nature of the Seahawks offense didn't have to deal with it. And he's proven his worth again with a talented group down in LA, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think you said that we only ran 20% of our plays were play action, which seems crazy given the success we've had on it in the past. So I think we made it slightly easy for Bradley. But yeah, he came up with a great game plan, and he might, I'm sure, when he went to bed on Sunday night, he was very relieved that Chris Carson was injured, because I think that could have been a deciding factor in the game in Carson. But ultimately, it's up to the Seahawks to be able to adjust and not be so heavily reliant on one player to win. But I thought Bradley called a great game.
Another thread coming out of the game on Sunday was the referees and some of their decisions, which, let's be fair, they did go both ways. I think the target in one that was... Was it against Derwin James on Tyler Lockett? I think that was just an absolute nonsense play. And obviously the big one was the Mike Williams touchdown when he appeared to clearly step out of bounds. It's just there was a lot of things at the front of the queue for people to play in the Bame game, and they really shouldn't have been there, should they?
No, I mean, the interesting point on the radio that they shouldn't really be allowed to wear white boots if they're going to have white sidelines, which isn't actually the silliest thing I've ever heard. It is quite important because to me it looked like actually his foot, his heel may have been slightly raised, but it does seem very strange that there aren't cameras that run from corner from along sideline so you can actually see this exactly. One thing I didn't realize, I heard this on the radio today, that only the main primetime game, if you have a game on primetime, there are more cameras on those games that are replay available than just your regular run-of-the-mill Sunday game, which does seem a bit crazy.
I think they're the only ones with gold pylon cams, aren't they, the primetime, the TV games, like the Sunday night and all
So they have more cameras. So, what with Demaryius Thomas in the first game of the season... and Williams in this game of season, you could look at two pretty important touchdowns that maybe with a better placed camera, we'd have got the call in our favour. I think this one was less obvious than Demaryius Thomas, which seemed very strange that one was given. But it did appear that his foot was at least hanging over the line, if not the heel was down. But that's the problem when you put so much weight on the on-field call. It's a bit like in cricket. I think they overvalue the on-field call for stuff like this. If something is... So something shouldn't have to be that clear and obvious if it's just, that looks pretty obvious. That should be enough, really.
I just think the refs is just such, it's with everything, they're such an easy target. So I think it was definitely wins around about because the Badgers were, in fact, penalised more than the Seahawks on Sunday, 12 for 105 compared to 10 flags on the Seahawks for 83. And third down conversion was a problem for both teams, with the teams going combined 6 for 24 on third downs, which is not the usual in NFL games. But one to praise on either side or overall, Adam?
One to praise. I don't really think anyone was particularly great, which is a bit of a shame.
I think it's boring, but I think Bobby...
Wagner, well, yeah, he was covering side to side.
That's what I was about to say. Bobby Wagner's probably the one...
I think Wagner's probably the one.
They didn't appear to be middle of field drop off when he was in the second half in place of McDougal, which is encouraging and interesting as the season moves along. I think probably Bobby Wagner on the offensive side. I don't know. No one really was there.
I'm going to say Vanette just for making that catch because he literally cheated. He cheated what humans are supposed to be able to do.
Yeah, so obviously now the Seahawks move on to face the LA Rams down in the Coliseum in Los Angeles this Sunday. And yesterday, when Bobby Wagner was asked what they have to do differently compared to the game in week 4 before the team made the trip over here, sometimes, as McDougal said, simplicity is the key.
What did you learn from the first matchup against the Rams?
We can't allow them to score as many points as they put up.
So yeah, that is when it's put like that, Adam, it's pretty simple and pretty straightforward. And it's weird that not people realise that. It kind of just comes down to something so clear and obvious.
Certainly a big fan of scoring more points than the opposition. And I think if that's the philosophy you have going into every game, more often than not, if you score more points, you'll win.
As I put on Twitter, that it's as people probably say, it's a beautiful opportunity to do that on Sunday as well, isn't it?
Very much so. I was trying to do a comeback with that, but say something else. But I think you just got the perfect Peterson for that. Actually,
the Rams did lose the first game of their 2018 season in anyone somehow missed it with the Seahawks game or something, go back and watch it. It's an absolute classic. And if it's actually an NFC title game coming in the end of January, then that could be for a few hours to rehash that. They lost to the Saints 45-35. Marcus Peters again was torched on the what ended up being really the game-winning play, a 70-odd yard touchdown to Michael Thomas. But after the loss against the Chargers, there's a very good chance it's all written off for 2018 for the Seahawks if they have back-to-back loss, isn't it?
I mean, I don't think it's being overly negative to say that you expect that we get absolutely hosed on Sunday.
The Vegas spread is 10.5.
And I would say that I think that might be a bit generous, to be honest. I mean, I know we played them really close and really well up in Seattle, but we were probably slightly healthier than we seemed like we might be on Sunday. It's obviously on the road versus being at home, and it's not the greatest of home field advantages down at the Coliseum. But I mean, the Rams are really, really good, and they're in a position where they could probably score a touchdown on every offensive drive they have. They've only punted about 8 times all season.
The Saints game on Sunday had 3 punts on both teams. Oh, actually, the Vegas right now is 9.5. It's coming down.
Whoa, we're coming back.
Yeah, I think Hecker's possibly thrown 30%. I think he's touched the ball 12 times and he's thrown it 3. I think that's what something ridiculous like that through the first 2 months of the season. So yeah, this offense, as I said, certainly find different way to put up 35 points, which is not the most encouraging thing, is it?
No, and also, you know, we have to find a way that we can score 35 points. The recipe that kept us in the game last time was that we always managed to keep it close. And I don't think it was ever a 2-score game. I don't think anyway. And if it was, it was, you know, only one drive for a period of one drive. It was a 2-score game. And we really have to maintain that on Sunday, because if we let this get away from us, it could get ugly.
Yeah. This has all the makings of an unpleasant evening. And the game is being shown on Sky Sports, which is always fun to see how people react to what the people in that Sky studio say as well, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, Neil Reynolds is obviously a real fan favourite amongst the UK Seahawk Nation, so I'm sure he'll get a very fair shrift of it from our fans.
Yeah, the Seahawks had to win for this offence to put up 35 points. They're going to need Tyler Lockett and Doug Baldwin to have a game where I don't think they've both had a 7-catch, 70-yard touchdown day together this season, have they? Doug Baldwin, obviously, last Sunday against Chargers. Lockett's been on an absolute tear for the first 6 weeks of the season. They haven't done it together, and it's probably going to be a game where it needs to happen this week, doesn't it?
Well, let's say for the sake of argument, if we're going to win, we probably have to put up 450 total offensive yards.
Yeah.
Which that's about right. So let's say at best we can run for 200. That's if Fluke is healthy, Carson's available, and we can keep things, you know, we can keep it close in order that we can run. So let's say 200 yard rushing for the team. So you need to find 250 passing yards. So yeah, I mean, really, you're going to need one guy to blow up and just have an amazing game. We're going to need production from all over the field. You're going to need more than one catch from Jaron Brown. You'll need, you know, more from Dixon, maybe more than the customary 2 or 3 passes from Vinette. You might need 5 or 6 catches from him. And Baldwin and Lockett are going to have to, yeah, combine for a lot. Because 450 is probably a conservative estimate for a win, to be honest.
It probably is. I'm trying to put pages on them. I'm trying to see how many yards we got a month ago. It's like an all hands on deck on Sunday, especially in their own backyard. But even with, as you say, not the biggest, even without the biggest home field advantage in the NFL. But after Sunday, there's kind of like no confidence in the Seahawks being able to draw up that many positive plays without Chris Carson, is there? There's been absolute no proof of that happening in the games where he's either been injured, not played, or not done anything, Adam.
Yeah, I mean, you were at the Arizona game where Carson didn't play. I don't think. And, you know, offensively, it was a disaster. So Wilson threw for 198 at home.
Really?
To the Rams. Yeah.
Okay.
And Carson ran for 116.
Yeah, okay.
So you're going to need more.
You're going to need probably 80, like 2 more drives from Russell Wilson. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, I mean, if Carson's not there, based on the games that, or the minutes that he's not been on the field for, it looks pretty grim. So he really does have to be available for us to have, you know, a puncher's chance, I'd say.
Yeah, it is. The more talk about it, the more look at the stats, it doesn't fill me with confidence ahead of Sunday. But also,
and it's also worth saying that the Rams got stuff on the goal line, I think, twice at least in that once. Game.
Yeah, I think Todd Gurley had a couple of walking touchdowns, and then I think he stopped at least once. They're definitely on the red zone far more often than we can get out. Well, we didn't get away with it, that we could get away with again on Sunday. So yeah, confidence is wavering the more we talk about it. But obviously, if the Seahawks do manage to somehow completely shut down an offense, which seems highly unlikely with how the McVay's got that team going on the offensive side of the ball, if they do escape with a win, that's two back-to-back losses for the Rams, and there's a gut check time for them. But also, it's a big deal with the strength of schedule tiebreakers, if it ever does come down to that at the end of the year in the playoff contention, isn't it, Adam?
Yeah, I think Carolina and Minnesota are doubly big games for that reason. Because I think if we are going to sneak in, it's going to be as a sixth seed, and those teams are probably the most likely ones you'll be competing for that sixth seed with. So I think all things considered, yeah, the tie break now, as soon as you get to week 10, I kind of feel that it becomes like, I know that Seahawks are 8-8, but there's been 9 weeks and there's 7 weeks to go or whatever it is. That when you get to double digit weeks, now it feels like you're at the proper business half of the end of the season, where every, you know, you start looking at permutations and you start worrying more about who's winning and who's around you. So yeah, you're right. The tiebreaker situation is really comes into play from now, I think.
Yeah, most definitely. But as I said, confidence is not high. Confidence high for you, Adam?
No, yeah. I think I'm going to get smoked, unfortunately.
I'd be quite surprised if this is anything less than a 13 point gap. I think 9.5 is quite, I don't know.
I mean, if you offered, this sounds ridiculous, but if you offered me now a cover of the spread, I would say take that, get home, and try and get right for the other games. Because if you can cover there, you might be able to win out almost. If you're good enough to cover this spread with the number of injuries that you're going to have likely on Sunday, fair play to them. That would be a good achievement.
So prediction, score prediction?
I think it will be 42-25 to the Rams.
I think it will be 34-20 to the Los Angeles Rams. One to watch, if anyone is to watch for the Seahawks on Sunday, who's going to be the most important player? It's probably going to be Carson, isn't it? His health, if he plays or not.
Yeah, I have a feeling that Penny's going to get more involved this week. I don't think Carson's going to play. They signed Tremaine Pope back to the practice squad. McKissic is a week out, so it would suggest to you that they need a couple more running backs. You know, that signing would suggest that they're a bit worried about depth at running back. And so I kind of feel that if Carson's not going to play, yeah, Mike Davis will get the start per se. But you know how they use these running backs to mix and match so much. And I think you could see Penny getting 12 to 15 touches. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what he's going to
offer. I mean, especially after how people reacted to last Sunday, if he come out and got a 70-yard, 2-touchdown game, it would be hilarious and enjoyable at the same time. So yeah, obviously not much confidence from ourselves on this. Obviously, Seahawks fans will be confident till the very end. But moving on, let's go back into the bin. This week's Get in the Bin.
First of all, this is an exciting time for our organization.
2017 Browns joined the 2008 Lions as the only teams to go 0-16.
Get in the bin.
Give me Josh Freeman, who was the 17th pick in the first round, over Cam Newton, who was the number one overall pick.
And the 2015 AP Most Valuable Player is Cam Newton.
Get in the bin.
Chip Kelly is an evolver, and he's a smart guy, and I think he's going to go to San Francisco and they're going to be a much more viable football franchise.
That the 49ers are expected to clean house and dismiss head coach Chip Kelly.
Get in the bin.
Yeah, this week's Get in the Bin, and I'm going to double dip someone I put in there a couple of weeks ago. I think last time Rob Staton was on the podcast, It put Matthew White up to the entire Dallas Cowboys franchise. Jerry Jones, after what was a pretty, not embarrassing, but to lose like in the style they did on Monday night to a Titans team who couldn't protect the quarterback. The quarterback didn't appear to, the team to have forgot how to be a quarterback in the NFL for the first 6 weeks or so of the season, to do that and then to then support the coach who is somehow the second longest tenured coach in that franchise is pretty storied history, let's be fair. And then to come out and say it doesn't matter what Dak does, he's going to be extended from Jerry Jones. It's just an absolute cluster. And it just seems no way of altering course, does it, in Dallas or at Jerry World?
No, they need, unfortunately, a big overhaul. If you can't even really get close to winning with a rookie quarterback deal, you're in trouble, and you're in the worst place in the NFL, which is purgatory. And I think Troy Aikman was right when he said that they're in need of a real overhaul. Interesting question. Would you rather be a fan of the Raiders or the Cowboys right now?
I don't know. The Raiders are moving to Vegas, but I don't know. The Raiders have...
Put it this way, the fact that it's even a question being mull over says a lot about what situation the Cowboys are in right now.
I don't know. Can I just stop watching the sport altogether?
Yes, you can.
Also, another one getting the bin for me is talking you just mentioned there. Troy Aikman, his reaction to Michael Thomas's phone celebration, which is the best thing since, well, no, not the best thing, because Tyler Lockett is choreographing celebrations for Seahawks. It's amazing. And he acted like he just jumped in and punched a fan in the face. If you go back and watch the end of the Rams game, his reaction to Michael Thomas is pretty inventive and pretty cool throwback to a former Saints player, Joe Horn, who did that probably a decade or so ago. It's really cool. And Troy Aikman just was like, get off his lawn kind of thing, wasn't he? It's just, come on, lad. Adam?
My get in the bin is for a group of teams, and it's for the rest of the AFC East that are not the New England Patriots. I mean, this is a piss take now. This has been 16, 17 years where you've all been ultimately a disgrace sport. And much as Belichick and Brady are incredible, the AFC East give the Patriots 5 wins at minimum a year. And then bear in mind, you play 2 teams each season that came second and third and fourth last year. The Patriots have got 9 wins a year before they even started. And it's just ridiculous. And it's no wonder they waltz into so many Super Bowls with so many home field advantages, because their division is an absolute embarrassment. Think a couple of years ago how bad the AFC South were. You've now got 3 teams there that are at worst very competitive, and the fourth one's the Titans, who just went to Dallas and won, so that's decent. That, you know, the NFC East is generally not that great, but at least all of them kind of play up and down to each other. But the AFC East, I mean, come on. 3 of you are an absolute laughingstock again this year, and it just, well, Brady's going to go through his entire career never having had a competitive AFC
East. The Dolphins are trying, to be fair.
They are, but you know, they're still putting a lot of eggs in Tannehill's basket, and you still see them saying Tannehill's a franchise quarterback. Tannehill's not a great player when he's fully healthy, let alone at this rate when he's missed, I think, 17 out of the last 23 games. So, I mean, come on, AFC, give us something, because it's getting silly now.
I'm going to put a third thing in, because you're talking about groups of people and teams, with one team more prominent than the others. The entire CFB, the entire NCAA, who allowed Alabama to get a proper quarterback in Tua, especially Mark Hurlick, where his name was, the former Oregon Ducks coach, who had him committed to the Oregon Ducks and decided he didn't like the left-handedness of him, I think it was. I mean, how have 200 college teams allowed this to happen, Adam?
Well, I mean, how have the Patriots been allowed to get Josh Gordon?
That's true.
It's almost true. The same thing, just from college to the NFL.
He's still got 2 years left. I mean, Alabama could score 50 for the next, 14, no, how many games are there? 40 odd weeks. It's just absolutely, there's no reason to have in the top 25 in college football. It's just Alabama. and then everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, Clemson are the only team in my, for my money, that might run them a bit close, because I think Trevor Lawrence can put up points. But yeah, that's about it.
After watching how they handled Penn State, who aren't great this year, Jim Harbaugh and that Michigan defense, they got three of their four cornerbacks or guys secondary starters in defensive backfield. I think they've given up 10 completions over the last six weeks of the season, which is just unbelievable, absolutely incredible. And I think they had two pick sixes on Sunday. And Jim Harbaugh's back to running up the score, which is always fun. Which means Jim Harbaugh is a lot of confidence in the players at his disposal at Ann Arbor.
As every team should run the score up, by the way. It's
it was 24-0 with 2 minutes to go in the third quarter, and Penn State had given up. I think they'd benched McSorley by this point, and they scored 18 points in 6 minutes. It was incredible. 17 points in 6 minutes. It was the best. Jim Harbaugh is back. One other thing, not out of the bin, because he's never been in the bin, but an anti get in the bin, someone to put some praise on. I don't think, obviously, Patrick Mahomes is, as I keep saying, the greatest ever to do it. Probably the story in the NFL this year is James Conner, the Pittsburgh running back. Obviously, all the stuff with Le'Veon Bell all off season, he was a fourth or fifth round pick out of Pittsburgh. He's from the area, and as anyone who listened to his podcast 18 months or so ago, he had quite a journey. Obviously, was diagnosed with cancer, missed an entire year at Pittsburgh, and now he's one of his top three rusher in the NFL and doing it for his hometown team. So a massive, don't think there's enough people paying attention to what James Conner is doing for the Pittsburgh Steelers. It is one hell of a story with all the negativity going around, especially with everything that's happened in that city intently over the last month as well, Adam.
For sure, and we should send our condolences to those in Los Angeles who have been affected by the shooting in the last day, I think, which the Rams, I imagine, will make some sort of reference to on Sunday in the game. What Connor's doing is amazing, and it just shows the strength of an offensive line, how important that can be to a rush game. If we're doing a kind of stay out of the bin card, then we are biased because he is a friend of the show and a friend of ours personally, but Michael Sean Dugar is churning out some amazing content, and his latest article with Dwayne Brown on The Athletic is, I would say, it's a must-read article. It's fascinating about the game of football, life, what it was like growing up, music, LeBron James. It's got a bit of everything, and I would suggest that if there is one article you can read this week, try and get onto The Atlantic and give that one a read.
Yeah, it's everything. As Adam said, it hits on his childhood, even just going back home to Richmond, Virginia, which we seem to have a bit of a soft spot for. Wes Wilson's from there, Michael Robinson's from there, Percy Harvin was from there, a few other people are from down there as well. But
Camp Chancellor?
That sounds about right. He's from Virginia anyway. So there seems to have a bit of a soft spot for that. But as Adam said, it is an amazing, and there's amazing read, and really interesting. He talks about all his protest stuff, if you want to call it that, when he's in Houston, and how much of a breath of fresh air Paul Allen was when he arrived in Seattle just over a year ago. It is amazing. As I said to Adam on text earlier, there's no one in the game doing it as well as Michael Sean Dugar. Is there, Adam?
Agreed. And yeah, he is the, as you said, he's the number one person to be following now.
If nothing else, managed to understand Terry Peppard as well.
That is true. Oh, there could be another interesting get in the bin that I've just seen. It's a video that's just broken on Twitter, and it's new video shows police pursuing Antonio Brown's black Porsche going over 100 miles an hour, and he was cited for reckless driving.
Oh, I saw someone tweet about going 135. I can barely go 35. I did wonder who that was about.
Yeah, it looks like it's Antonio Brown.
Imagine, like, I know everything's going on in Oakland, but imagine if there was like Amazon or at Pittsburgh this year.
God, he is gunning it. I've just watched the video. Antonio Brown.
Okay, then before we wrap up, we're going to run through some of your questions. Adam actually got responses to that this week. I don't get any responses, so maybe that's the way forward, Adam. Daniel Sharp wants to know, we've already touched on this a bit, Daniel Sharp wants to, suggesting that Rashad Penny is a bust. He doesn't seem to be capitalising on his opportunities. and has failed to make an impact. That's untrue and unfair at this point, isn't it, as we said earlier?
Yeah, I mean, I can see why people say that, because you expect impact from your first round pick, especially when the coaches say they want to rebuild the run game. So I don't think it's, you know, necessary. It's not that glib a comment to make, I don't think. But I think he's a guy, and certainly A, needs and deserves patience. But I think the guy's probably touched the ball about 30 times offensively. And a lot of running backs, if you listen to what they say in articles or whatever, they're almost like cricket bowlers, where they're trying to, they need that rhythm. And they need to run 5 or 6 times in a row to get the rhythm. And he's just not being given that, because it's one run here, it's two runs there. And so I think we need to see a lot more of him before we can make any long-term proclamations about him. But I mean, obviously it's not been an ideal start, and he doesn't look as electric as we may have hoped, but I think there's a lot more to see from him.
Yeah, I just need to look at Marvin Gordon, his rookie year, and how he struggled just doing anything, really. And that O-line isn't that much different than it is right now in San Diego a couple of years ago. Dave Bailey wants to know if there's anyone we can cut before week 10 to call back a compensatory pick if needed. I don't think there is anyone. I think the likeliest one would have been Ed Dixon, but now he's active and playing and seems to be a pretty important part of the offense. Apart from last Sunday, I don't think there's going to be anyone, is there?
I don't even think comp picks work if you cut players in the season, do they? I thought they have to be free agents at the end of the year.
I think, I'm not sure it's week 10, because I think when we cut Jamarcus Webb a couple of years ago, we cut him a week too late to try and get back the comp pick calculation or something. I don't know.
But
I think it was when Bradley Sowell got injured. They had to keep him for an extra week. I think that kind of did this. And Mark Woodcock talked about the refs, as we did, and then he wants to know, once they activate McKissick, which appears to be next week at this point now, who gets cut? He says it's hopefully Prosize, who's another one who's just not getting any looks, and Pete Carroll said yesterday that he's dying to play. That's probably too short of a swap, but it kind of makes the most sense, doesn't it?
I can't imagine who it would be if it wasn't Prosize. I don't know if there's a lineman somewhere that, you know, that there's, you know, they've got one too many defensive or offensive linemen that they can get rid of, but I can't see who else it would be off the top of my head, aside from CJ Prosize.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, Naz Jones isn't active. We didn't talk about that. The fact that Marvin Gordon had 113 yards on the ground, the Seahawks only had two traditional, shall we say, defensive tackles activated, with Naz Jones out and Puna Ford inactive as well. It was strange roster management. Mark Jackson wants to know, after losing Carson during the game, why do we look so one-dimensional and seem to have no plan B? Was it a bad set of game combo, such as Russell not being on it, or is it symptomatic of more fundamental problems and we got found out a little? I just think the team's limitations were exposed, weren't they?
Yeah, I think the way they want to play is keep the game close or be in the lead, and they're just not built to be a score and a half or two scores behind. And I think Mark's right that it is one dimensional, and the fears that we all had about Schottenheimer and the offensive scheming at the start of the year have really come to light in certain games, and that was just one of them. Unfortunately, I don't think you're going to see an awful lot of change, because this is obviously the way Pete Carroll wants to play. So in a way, it's kind of all the things that Mark said packaged into one.
For the foreseeable, it appears, as well. Mike, no, he's asking if you're on the podcast, Seahawkers 1. Alan Kennedy wants to know if we think Russell Wilson is happy with the play calling and the coordinator, and do we think he would be outspoken if he isn't? Not on your Nelly would he be outspoken, and I don't think he is happy, but I think he just kind of... There's probably 52 other players more likely to call out the play calling than Russell Wilson on his team, isn't there?
He is obviously just robotic with his responses to stuff like that, and he's never going to call it out, but it wouldn't surprise me if he's very pissed off by the way some of this stuff is happening around him.
And obviously Mike Wilcox also mentions the fact that Bruce Irvin was released by the Raiders over the weekend, and yesterday signed a pretty hefty 1-year deal in Atlanta, paying just over $3 million, and just wants us to discuss that. I mean, it sounds like the Seahawks were in the running, but the price that Atlanta paid, which apparently wasn't as much as what he was offered by the Patriots and the Steelers. They were never going that high for Bruce Irvin, and it's pretty cool that he gets to go home and play in Atlanta for the next 2 months at least, Adam.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think that the Seahawks are that interested in bringing back players that slated them after Super Bowl 49, and Bruce Irvin was the first person to call out like the entire coaching staff at the end of that game. The way they've done everything in the last 2 years was just getting rid of noise and voices in the locker room. And whilst I'm sure they inquired about Irvin, it wouldn't surprise me if of the four main teams that were competing for him, our offer was the most derisory, to be honest, for that reason. Because he doesn't strike me as a kind of player that was particularly beloved by Pete Carroll.
He is what exactly the lot we spoke about with Mike Dugas about the line Doug Baldwin treads. Bruce Irvin went past it more often than not and continued to in Oakland as well. I mean, this is F the Saints tweet went viral around Falcons Twitter yesterday from a few years ago after all the Jimmy Graham stuff before the playoff game, 2 months before we traded for him. So that could be fun when they play them later in the season. Yeah, massive thanks to everyone who sent questions in to Adam's post. Continue to get involved even when we don't ask for it.
Yeah, let's do that more regularly.
To send questions, or if you've got ideas for bits for the podcast, if you've got an idea for a name for the anti get in the bin, I would appreciate that because I'm running on empty for that. Quickly before we properly wrap up, week 10 NFL lock or shock. Adam, I'll go first because I'm imagining you haven't got the schedule up. My lock of the week is going to be, I mean, it's probably going to be every week till kingdom come. The Chargers to win in Oakland at the Raiders. Anyone for you?
I saw that the Jets seem to be starting with Josh McCown this week, although they're playing the Bills, so they're probably going to win that one anyway. The lock of the week has got to be the Chiefs at home to the Cardinals, I think.
Oh, yeah, that could be. Oh, it's a good week to have Tyreek Hill in fantasy, hopefully. shock of the week, Adam?
Shock of the week, the Seahawks. No. Shock of the week. I don't know if it's a shock, but I think the 49ers will beat the Giants.
That was one I was looking at. Yeah, that was pretty impressive from them against being the Oakland Raiders have quit on John Gruden, don't they? Holy mother.
Yeah, I think Gruden has to be given... I think you've got to give Gruden 3 years to kind of cash in on all the picks that they've accumulated before you can fire him. But, I mean, he really is walking a tightrope of shite, let's be honest.
Yeah, and then for me, I'm going to go with... I'm gonna continue with my weird fascination in this team this year. I think the Dolphins are gonna go into Lambeau and win. Rashad Jones had a pretty good season. Cameron Wake is having a decent season. Robert Quinn seems to be back to what he was, and the running game seems to do enough. Frank Gore is just ageless. He's some of the cuts he was making against the Jets are just ridiculous. Brian Baldinger highlighted them on his Twitter a few days ago. I think that is gonna be my shock of the week. But I also, if Josh McCown does play for the Jets, don't count out the Bills because they were a quarterback away from winning against New England, and the Jets aren't as good on the offensive side as the Patriots are with Tom Brady.
But they're still a quarterback away from beating a fireball gang select 11, let's be honest.
Probably.
You and I could shut down Nathan Peterman if we were opposing corners to each other.
Is he playing again this week? I saw that Josh Allen was starting to throw again with his whatever he's got.
If Allen's playing, that's a different scenario. But I was under the impression that Allen's not healthy.
He probably isn't. That's our locks and shocks. Probably going to be wholeheartedly wrong, especially my Dolphins one. But I've got faith in them for some weird reason the last few weeks. Other business for the chapter. 2019 membership is opening up soon. All the information will be on the Facebook page via either Sean or Cedric over the coming days, probably over the weekend at some point, because the confirmation for everything was done over the weekend. There is a meet in Newark in Nottinghamshire this Sunday. Kieran Burns organised at a pub local to him, and obviously with the game being on Sky, that's got a lot easier for Kieran to organise. So if you're in the area or if you're on the web, do head over. All the information is on the Facebook group. It'll be going out on Twitter in the next hour, in the coming days before that on Sunday as well. Then obviously in a few weeks against the at the 49ers, there is a meet going on up in Glasgow. Both the Gordons have found a venue which seems pretty cool and has a pretty tasty food menu if you want to go hungry to that. That's for the 49ers game in San Francisco. And then the Super Bowl meet is happening on the 3rd of Feb, Super Bowl night at O'Neill's in Birmingham on Broad Street. If you want to get in touch with us on the podcast, you can via the Facebook page, the Possession Podcast, or the group Facebook page, UK Seattle Seahawks Fans on Twitter and Instagram. It's Seahawkers UK. On Instagram, it's UK Seahawkers. Personal is Stu _ Court and at Adam D. Nathan. We will be back next week with a podcast. Some point next week, obviously, the Seahawks play. And the Neon Green is back next week, Adam, against the Green Bay Packers on Thursday Night Football. So, yeah, probably you'd expect the last time you see that. So we'll try and maybe do a podcast earlier in the week next week with the Thursday night game. Enjoy the game from whatever corner of the world or the British Isles and Ireland or Europe you're watching it from. Until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Go Hawks!
Hey, sometimes a lion misses the gazelle, bro.
Say what?
Sometimes a lion misses the gazelle.
Yeah.
You know what I'm
saying? Yeah.
Whoever told you that you could work with men? What you're hired for is to help us. Does that seem clear to you? To help us. To help men who are going out there to try to earn a living.